This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, MP Mike Helloway talks about a promotion enabling him to have a direct pipeline to the Prime Minister. A local musician is hoping his band will pick up some hardware at the ECMAs, and the Sydney Airport CEO is rolling out the welcome mat for WestJet and Air Canada. These stories are coming up on Dialogue. Airport CEO Mike McKinnon says there is some light in the tunnel after flights were grounded in Sydney because of COVID-19, and he spoke about that to Dialogue's Dave DeVoe.
Okay, so I know you've got some good news lately that Air Canada and WestJet will be coming back in June. So first of all, just wondering how you took that news, what you're doing in response to it, and if there's anything else you're asking in terms of assistance from the province or Ottawa that maybe you haven't got yet or haven't got assurance of yet.
Okay, so I'll start with the news we received from WestJet last week, and that was that they plan to resume operations on June 28th, and that will be a single flight this summer, at this point in time anyway, between Sydney and Halifax. And obviously we were very pleased to see that announcement. It really sends you know, it tells us that there's some confidence in our market, and great news to receive. Just the week prior, Air Canada had indicated, they didn't do a press release, but they indicated that they plan to restart the Toronto service on June 1st, so the first flight from Toronto down to Sydney would come down on June 1st, and our first departure from Sydney back to Toronto would operate on June 2nd, early morning. And also they tell us that the Air Canada flights to Halifax are still in the system for booking, and they're targeting June 22nd for those flights. And they have the Montreal flight in the system as well, and the target start date is June 27th. And so that's all great news, but I guess the proviso is it really depends on what passenger demand looks like, which in part is really, you know, we'll follow how the travel restrictions look and, how the COVID situation plays out. But, you know, at this point in time, after a year of what we've been through, it's really exciting to have that news. And so you asked, what are we doing? Well, you know, we're pretty much ready to go. I mean, it's a matter of airlines bringing their staff back in. Some of our staff come back when flying increases, which is great news. And the airport itself is in good shape. It's well maintained, and you know, we have to do a few little tweaks here and there to get ready for operations again. But we're certainly looking forward to those dates.
Now, in terms of assistance from the province or Ottawa, is there anything else you think they can do at this point to get you better prepared, be in a better position to run once things get moving again?
Well, throughout the pandemic, we've been advocating through not only individually as an airport authority, but also through the Atlantic Canada Airports Association and the Canadian Airports Council. We've been advocating to the federal government for assistance, not only for the airports across the country that have suffered through the pandemic, but also our, help for our airline partners, because, without the airline partners getting the support they need, we're not going to have anyone flying. If we don't have anyone flying, there's no revenue for the airport. So that work continues. There's been promises made by the federal government that they're going to help regional airports, and we've already had some meetings with them to discuss that, so it's kind of moving in the right direction, I would say. And as far as the airlines, the big players, WestJet, Air Canada, like national airlines, those conversations are also underway and have been underway for some time with the federal government, and I'm hearing that those conversations are moving in a positive direction. So, those are good things to know. On the provincial side, we did see a story in the Halifax Herald a couple of weeks back that the finance minister, Labbé Kosciuszko, was looking at support for Halifax and Sydney airports, And so we were quite anxious and watching the budget last week, but we didn't see anything in the budget that indicated there was some help for the airport. So we're trying to meet with the minister and the premier to have a discussion about, you know, what the province can do. And the way we see it is, you know, the Sydney Airport it's regulated by the federal government, but it's not run by the government. It's a private, not-for-profit airport run for the community and to provide the air services that Cape Breton Island needs. But it's a valuable piece of infrastructure for the province of Nova Scotia. So it's our position that the province certainly could help us with some of the challenges we see as we recover and try and get air service back in place. So we're going to have those discussions. A little too early to say, you know, how they're going to play out, but talks are underway, I would say.
I know one of the things that you and some other people in the community brought up before is the idea of testing at airports and maybe if there's some role for the public health officer and the health department to maybe sign off on that. Has there been any more talk on that front?
Yeah, there was a point in time where, you know, as an airport community, we were trying to do whatever we could to try and, you know, help our industry recover and get back in the business we're in, which is flying and moving passengers across the country and connecting them to international flights, things like that. With the increased rollout or the more rapid rollout of the vaccination programs, testing at airports has kind of taken a back seat at this point in time. Not to say that it couldn't be part of the solution as we go forward to enable safe travel in our industry and ensure that we are providing safe travel. But at this point in time, the focus from the health departments seems to be on rolling out the vaccines as rapidly as possible and getting the level of vaccinations in our province and across the country up to a level where, you know, hopefully you'll see a relaxation of some of these travel restrictions at some point in time, hopefully this summer.
Yeah, one would certainly hope that, but I mean, we're seeing talk of third and fourth waves now in some places. Hopefully, you know, we manage to keep our distinction as one of the safest places in North America in that regard. But, I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, might it not be prudent to just be prepared in case, God forbid, we get hit harder here and the regulations don't get pulled back as quickly as we would hope?
Absolutely. And we've indicated to the province, and I know Halifax has as well, because they still have airplanes, you know, operating, and they did all through the pandemic. They weren't shut down like we were. That we're 100% supportive of any health authority initiatives to, you know, do testing at airports. So we're ready to do it. Right now, I think it's a matter of resources for the health department that, you know, they're putting so much focus on the vaccinations that once they get through that program, if they feel there's a need to test at airports, we're there and ready to do it. So we've indicated that, and we're fully supportive if that's a requirement.
Okay. I'm wondering, just give us a little bit more of a sense of what the effective shutdown at the airport has meant for the workers there. I can't remember exactly how many people have been laid off temporarily. What was that number again?
Well, our numbers vary by season. So summer season, we normally would have about 19 people employed by the airport authority themselves. This year, we were down to 9 people. And in the winter season, we normally bring in between 3 and 5 seasonal staff to help with runway clearing and snow clearing, things like that. We didn't do that this winter. We shut down operations from the hours of 6 in the evening till 6 in the morning once that last Air Canada flight operated on the 11th of January. We kind of went into a winter hibernation mode. We were still keeping things open for the medevac flights and cargo flights and Casera, the search and rescue flights and training flights, things like that. So we were actually quite lucky. The winter was pretty easy on us. and we didn't have any major issues at the airport throughout the winter, and now we'll probably get a dusting or two before May comes. But, you know, we're lucky, and now we're kind of looking forward to getting into June and being able to bring back a few of our staff. And as the flights increase, you know, our staffing level will come back to normal. And hopefully the airlines and the car rental company and the restaurant and all of the other service providers at the airport will do the same, and life will start to resume, you know, somewhat normal semblance when we get into the later summer and into the fall.
So right now you've got assurances that certain flights are going to be reestablished. Are you confident that process is going to continue, that you'll be able to, say, by this time next year, if all goes well, offer the same amount of flights to the same amount of destinations that you were?
That's never a sure thing, Dave, and that's the nature of the business. So, you know, if passenger demand is there, if demand comes back, the airlines will put the capacity on that they feel is required. So we're pretty confident. We know there's pent-up demand this summer. We anticipate leisure travel with those targeted dates in June will be pretty busy. Business travel, probably not so much. A lot of people will continue maybe to use Zoom, but I think eventually business travel will get reestablished. But that might take some time. That might take a year or two, maybe longer. So, you know, as the airlines understand what passenger demand looks like, what the comfort level is for people to travel, and what are the markets and how the traffic flows look, then they'll be looking at what the schedules will look like. So, you know, this summer, you know, we have a schedule that on paper looks fantastic. It parallels what our schedule last summer would have looked like, which was going to be our busiest year ever last year. And so we're anticipating that if those planes do operate, we should see some reasonable demand, and then we'll slowly build on that as people gain more and more confidence that the pandemic's under control and it's okay to travel. I think we'll see things slowly return to normal. But there's never a sure thing when it comes to airline schedules and the capacity.
No, and I mean, I guess more generally, too, I know the cruise ship industry locally as well has been talking about pent-up demand for 2022, but you never know, you know, what's going to happen between now and then. But what I think I hear you saying is that if demand picks up, you know, as most experts expect, you expect to offer basically comparable services to pre-pandemic, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Absolutely, and that's the key. You know, our market, our services are, you know, a couple of flights, two or three flights a day. Well, in the summer, normally we would have four flights a day to Halifax, so there's a variety of choice options for scheduling and connecting to other flights. Toronto, in peak summer, we would normally have two flights a day, an Air Canada and a WestJet. This year, WestJet have yet to decide whether they'll operate their flight. And the Montreal flight, of course, is a new flight that started in 2019. 2020 was going to be its second summer, and that's a flight that we're targeting to build traffic on that route with Air Canada so that eventually it could become possibly a daily service 12 months of the year. And that's the goal for that flight, because it gives our, you know, our clients and our customers here another option for connecting across Canada and internationally through the major hub that Montreal is for Air Canada.
So, Mike, just to give you an opportunity to give a kind of last pitch here, if an MP or MLA is listening to this interview, what would you want them to hear in terms of what's going on and what they can do to help improve, move the situation along, and help the airport?
Well, I'm in discussions often with our MPs, Mike Calloway and Jaime Batiste, and they've been very supportive and vocal. And Mike now has the position as chair of the Atlantic Liberal Caucus, which is exciting news for us. But Mike's been a great advocate for the airport. So they're well aware of where we sit as far as the funding issue. Like I said, the talks are underway. We expect these things to pick up some speed over the next few weeks. So that, I think that's important that we keep the pressure on that front. Provincially, you know, what I think our airport needs is the same kind of support that Halifax Airport has had in the past from the province, which would be, you know, air access funding to help us attract and retain air service here in Cape Breton, and possibly some funding on the infrastructure front, because coming out of the pandemic, the cash reserves we had been putting away to help with things like runway rehabilitation, those cash reserves have been significantly depleted, and we're going to need some help to get those projects completed.
I know there's virtually nothing that the municipality can do in terms of funding that would make much of a difference, but I do know that Mayor McDougall and councillors, in association with local businesses, have been advocating pretty hard for the airport. Has that advocacy made much of a difference in as far as you can see?
Absolutely it has, yes. You know, it's the collective voice. It's the collective voice of our community. So, you know, it's not the airport, by ourselves crying in the wind. It's our community who understand the importance. So these leaders who've been engaged and are advocating on our behalf, they understand the importance of having our community connected by air for investment purposes, for the university. It's a huge deal for the university to have an airport within 10, 15 minutes of their campus. And that helps to draw the international students, which are a big, obviously the majority of students at CBU now are international. And, the Cape Breton Partnership and their investment program and the Chamber of Commerce and the mayor's office, they've all been 100% behind the efforts to advocate on behalf of the airport. And that work continues. We're still involved in advocacy work and trying to, improve service at the airport. So, great job by everyone, and I'm very thankful for the support that we've been given to date.
Yeah, you might think of the airport not just as, a place for planes to fly in, but more broadly as an economic development asset.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, we inject millions of dollars into the economy directly and indirectly through the trickle-down effect of all of the employees, the taxes we pay and our employees pay, and the secondary services that come and go and work at the airport and provide services. So, it's a huge impact. If the airport isn't viable, it would be a significant drawback for the community. But we're excited. I think we're going to get through this. I think the summer, this news is, it's good news to get at this point, especially after such a long year. And, hopefully, I think the big hurdle going forward this summer will be, when will we see travel restrictions relax? And, of course, that depends on things like the vaccination rollout and the pandemic, the state of the number of cases. But if we can see the 14-day isolation relax sometime this summer, I think that's when we're really going to see air service take off.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Mike?
No, that's a great chat. Thanks, Dave. I appreciate the time.
Cape Breton is well represented for the upcoming East Coast Music Awards set for Sydney in May. Mike Leliev is a member of the popular trio Holler, and they are nominated in the Rising Star Recording of the Year category. Paul McDougall caught up with Mike on The Good Sentence.
So I've got Mike Leliev here with me discussing about their recent ECMA nomination for Rising Star. Now, many people will know Mike. He's been around the music scene in Cape Breton for years and years and years. But they've got a new band, and it's called Holler. And for those in the listening audience out there, it's not somebody who yells. It's somebody who pulls. Would that be right, Mike?
Yeah, we're hauling all over the countryside when this pandemic is over. That's what we're going to do.
For Holler is a recent band creation of you, Stephen McDougall, and Colin Grant, correct? We got the lineup right?
You got her.
Okay, for those that may not know Mike and Stephen for years were part of the trio of Slow Coaster, which also has sort of a locomotive-y name to it as well. Tell us kind of what Holler is about, like the band and this CD and the style of music.
Well, it's got more of traditional Cape Breton undertones. We got Colin playing wonderful fiddle lines, and me and Steven are playing acoustic guitar and a banjo. And yeah, we're doing a more folky, traditional kind of approach to things, but still, you know, still having all the fun. And we've kind of all known each other for years and years, and this was just a band that kind of happened out of us being friends and enjoying each other's music, you know. It was just one of those easy scenarios. Me and Colin play shows around town, and me and Steve have been playing together for years in different kind of scenarios with Slow Coaster, and we just decided we wanted to play some shows together, and it was so fun and so easy, we decided just to record an album and go after it.
So, had you gotten many shows in before? Because really, we're talking last March, the pandemic started a year ago now.
Yep, we decided the smartest thing to do was to release an album when there was a global pandemic, you know, really maximize our sales and our touring possibilities. but yeah, we had started working on it and had a video ready that we shot with Matthew Ingram, who's a great local video guy, and we recorded over at Sound Park with Jamie Foltz, who is a wizard in the studio, and yeah, and decided, you know, that pandemic was a perfect time to put it out. And then we've done a couple of online shows and things like that, but we haven't really gone out and toured the album.
No.
No.
But
we're excited to do that.
Yeah.
So
you're like everyone else. The time will eventually come. Let's talk about that video. Was that from The Widow's Vow?
Yep. There's two. The Widow's Vow one was one that Steven made. And he did. He made some paper mache dolls, and did some shooting around his house. And we thought it was kind of the right kind of folk art and the right amount of creepiness to really bring the song together and in a nice video form. And the first one we put out was more of a kind of a studio representation of us hanging out at Jamie's for The Wind That Shakes the Barley, which is a traditional song that we remade into a newer kind of version of it, I guess.
The album's got, what, about 10, 12 tunes on it, songs?
So, yeah, I think it's 10
yeah,
tracks.
Yeah, and I it's almost bookended by, to me, if you go theme-wise, that song, which is the traditional one from written in the you know, mid-1800s, to The Widow's Vow, which was, that's a song that Stephen wrote, right? And the lyrics, and you guys all worked on that song, but that song, when you listen to it, it seems like that song would have been written in the same time period. Want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the headspace that we're going for. We're kind of embracing our Cape Breton roots and stuff like that, and taking a little bit of a traditional approach to our songwriting with this project. We're all fans of all types of music, you know, jazz and rock and classical and country and heavy metal and whatever you want to kind of classify your music as. And for this one, we decided that we kind of want to have a little bit of a traditional Cape Breton old time feel to the music, and we kind of wrote in the vein of these older kind of concepts, and that one came out really well. I started with a guitar riff, and then we started putting some fiddle and threw some lyrics together, and there's a nice surprise ending to the song that kind of comes out of left field. it was a conscious effort by all three of us to kind of have a little bit of a more like I said, traditional old-timey approach to this this project.
It's a lovely song. It's a really good song, and the lyrics are really good. And it's, if there was a Stephen King song on the on your album, that's the one. And so if one was kind of laying back or sitting back and listening to the song, and then all of a sudden what happens, that's one thing. And you think, oh, gosh, didn't expect that. But then if you're watching the video with these marionette things, which are really, really cool way to do that, it adds another perspective to that. I mean, I think you sort of downplayed how good, how it might have been simple to make those things. But when you're looking at watching that video, though, those two little marionettes about the sailor that comes ashore and the woman that finds them, they, after a while, they become pretty realistic. To me, they do anyway.
Tugging on the old heartstrings, I guess, is what their jobs are.
Yeah,
little marionettes.
Yeah.
It's a pretty interesting video for sure. And like I said, Stephen did that. He made them all himself, and put the whole thing together.
It
came off great. I really liked it myself as well.
It's interesting because many years ago I took some Gaelic lessons, didn't get too far. I learned how to count the 1 to 10 and days of the week and stuff. But we would, at the end of the kind of class, we'd try to sing one or two Gaelic songs, right? And they'd always be so beautiful, right? And these lovely lilts to them. And you just almost, it could bring tears to your eyes how lovely they were. And then most people in the class were all novices, so we never knew what the songs were about. And then the instructor would tell you what the song was about, right? And it usually always involved like some kind of horrific death or murder, or someone being thrown
fair.
Off a boat.
Yeah, you're not wrong. That's I guess what was going on at the time.
Another one, Goodbye, and I feel it's like I can. It's like you're, to me, like you're almost channeling all these other musical styles. In Goodbye, I almost hear a little John Allen in there. And then I think I hear John Prine. And then I think, God, this is like listening to Steve Earle or something. All these different types of singers and songwriters. And they're all kind of meshed into this one, all people I like and admire. And they're meshed into this really cool song, that song Goodbye. Does it just... come like as a songwriter and singer, and how you do that and just make it all work, and you put your own like stamp on it?
Yeah, I mean, that's some pretty great references to be throwing around. I mean, like, John Prine is a great storyteller, obviously, and Steve Earle, he's got some amazing storytelling songs too, and John Allen Cameron, I mean, he is a national treasure.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things where you do kind of get yourself into a headspace, and you pick up the guitar, and a certain sound will come out of what you're messing around with, and hopefully you'll be inspired to tell a little bit of a story or put a few words together that you're inspired by the music, or sometimes it works in reverse where you'll have a little a concept that you're thinking about, like, I don't know. Like somebody going off to make moonshine on the Copperhead Road or something like that, and then you have a little story and you build the song around it. So it's like it goes both ways, where you can be inspired by a sound first, or you can be inspired by the story and kind of come to the end point, bounce it off the other guys in your band, and kind of get a little bit of that crossover style where you have maybe a little bit of a traditional fiddle solo in a bluegrass kind of flavored song, and at the end of the day, it comes out sounding like all of your favorite people, but with a little piece of your own heart in there, I guess, is a good way to say it.
There's this other one on the album, "The Love of Lost Sake." So this, it was an old song, old music, but write new lyrics to it. Tell us about that one.
That's exactly what it was. It was a project Colin and Steve were put together in some kind of writing workshop, I think, that Celtic Colors had put on for 1 year, where they were applying some old music to some new ideas, and they came up with this, and then years later, of course, when we're sitting around working on songs for this album, we kind of revisited this song and worked it so that it worked for all of us, and I really liked that song as well, and kind of brought it to life, it's a nice little ditty.
There's a story, a runner named Jody was raising money for the Children's Wish Foundation or one of those organizations for somebody, and he wanted to run the Cabot Trail, like the whole trail himself, and he was on French Mountain ready to give up, and his... he had a support car, his wife, I guess, or somebody. They were blasting Holler out the window, and one of Colin's songs was on just when Jody was, I guess, ready to just... He couldn't haul it any longer, but but he did. Is that right? It's just like that one gave him the momentum to keep going?
Yeah, you're right on that one. I guess the fiddle captured his soul when he was feeling weak and helped him get over French Mountain.
Yeah.
I think that was all him. I don't know how much we had to do with that. I know I didn't run over a mountain to raise a bunch of money for people who need it, but that makes us feel good that people are enjoying our music enough to run over mountains to it.
Well, the metaphor doesn't escape me. You hauled him, in some way, you hauled him up over French Mountain. You know?
Well, you're right. We should get all the credit. We shouldn't.
I've bicycled up over that mountain numerous times during Cabot Trail bicycle rides at the Velo Club, right? And that is a chore in itself. And we take 4 days to do the whole trail on bicycles, where when you come down, you can cruise down. So, shout out to Jody there for doing that last summer, I guess it was, eh?
Yeah, it's amazing. Amazing.
That's great. So, listen, your Holler has been, you've got an ECMA nomination for Rising Star, which is kind of nice. I mean, you're all well-established people anyway, but, I mean, Holler is a new invention, so that's great. Congratulations on that. The ECMA is when? Early May?
Yeah, 5th to the 9th, I think, is when they are.
And it's in Sydney.
In beautiful Sydney, Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, Canada.
Yeah, and they're going to attempt, looks like it's looking good for a live show with, limited seating, I suppose, how they'll figure all that out at Center 200, correct? This would be the big show. Yeah.
The gala is at Center 200 on the Thursday of that.
Yeah, and you're playing? You guys are playing?
Yep. We're going to be there. I'm actually not 100% sure as to how everything's going to go either, but I'm sure it's all going to be socially distanced and everybody will have a glass bubble over their head in some way or something like that. Nowadays, there's usually some kind of online streaming component.
Right.
Thinking they'll probably do something like that.
Yeah.
But as far as really exploding the community and all the venues and stuff like that with music, I'm not sure how that's going to look this year.
Right.
But we're hopeful that there should be some wonderful shows taking place.
Mm-hmm.
Either if it's behind closed doors or if there's limited capacity, pretty excited to see a lot of my music buddies and see some good tunes and have a good time.
Just before we go, I'd like to mention the other Cape Breton nominees for the ECMAs: Bioluck, Jimmy Rankin, Mike McKenna Jr., Norma McDonald, Jordan Musician, Maxine Cormier, Gervais Cormier, Pretty Archie, Celtic Colors International Festival, Jamie Folds, Mike Sheppy Shepherd, Lakewind Studios, and last but not least, Sound Park Studios. So good luck to all of them, and hope to see you somewhere live soon, Mike. So take care.
Absolutely. Appreciate it. Thanks.
The Cape Breton Cans OMP says his team has been busy in the first quarter of 2021. Mike Holloway says COVID-19 is exhausting and work continues to make sure everyone is vaccinated as soon as possible. And in the meantime, a few developments in his office, including being elected to be the voice for Atlanta Canada's Members of Parliament.
It's been exceptionally busy. I think that can be said for most of us in all of our walks of life. Yeah, working very closely with the constituents in my riding on a variety of personal items, community items, and regional and national items has been an amazing experience. And as we continue to kind of bring forth COVID measures that are helping Canadians and post-COVID measures that are going to help Canadians, has been exceptionally busy from the airport working on our budget submission that will focus, at least from my perspective, my budget submission has focused on having a national dialogue on basic income, to more supports for economic development and the fisheries, to support for seniors and support for health care, in particular pharmacare and long-term health care standards that are national in scope. So it does run the gamut, but that's why I signed up. And I got to say, Bill, I mean, for your listeners out there, I mean, and everyone gives back to their community in their own way. For me, there's no better, you know, gift than acting in the service of others and being that voice for my riding in Ottawa. And I can't speak highly enough of the people of Cape Breton Canso and not only the support they've given me, but the ideas they've given me in terms of informing policy. And, you know, we've seen policy measures for fishers select to a large degree. Cape Breton Council played a main role in that, and that came from fishers' families throughout the riding. So really enjoying the job, and we have a lot of challenges. We have a lot of opportunities, and I think now is the time we're at a pivotal point in Canada, in the history of Canada, where we've had a national, international pandemic, and now we need to find our way out of it. I'm looking forward to playing a role in doing so.
And you were recently elected Atlantic Liberal Caucus Chair. What does this job entail?
Well, yeah, thanks for that, Bill. I was very, again, gratitude is, I guess, a value that I would highlight here. Gratitude and very humbled to, in a very short period of time as an elected official, be recognized by my peers in Atlantic Canada for them to ask me to take on this position. So really, the job is an opportunity. The being a chair is the opportunity to work with the other Atlantic MPs to put forward to National Caucus, the Prime Minister and Cabinet, the challenges that Atlantic Canada faces, the opportunities, the programming that Canadians and Atlantic Canada can pursue. So it's really being a coordinated voice in Caucus, National Caucus, on behalf of Atlantic Canada. So working with the Atlantic Canadian MPs, but getting that message across on every topic that you can imagine that are important to Atlantic Canadians, and being that kind of conduit, that kind of that hub of coordination and communication for Atlantic Canada as it pertains to National Caucus, the Prime Minister, and Cabinet.
So you have the ear of the Prime Minister. So how do you approach this opportunity? Do you present a wish list of regional issues, or do you focus more on one or two priorities and keep those on the front burner until you get results? Because, like you said, there's a National Caucus meeting every week. So, yeah, how do you go about taking on this opportunity?
Sure. So let me walk through the process for you and the listeners out there. So every Wednesday, we have a two-hour Atlantic Caucus meeting where we're talking about the issues of the day that impact Atlantic Canadians. What I'm going to be doing is that I go to the mic about 2 hours after that to speak to what was brought up. But my approach is going to be to look at one or two issues a week that I can do a deep dive on. Some caucus chairs will look at that as an opportunity to provide 20 topics, and that may work for them. For me, I want to be able to portray a picture clear, concise picture of a topic or two that are important to Atlantic Canadians. For example, PharmaCare. I just don't want to say PharmaCare is important to Atlantic Canada. We know that. They know that. I want to be able to do a deep dive in the period that I have with the Prime Minister and Cabinet as to why it is important.
How much influence has this position had on the Prime Minister and his Cabinet in the past?
It's a great question. Caucus reports and caucus communication and caucus credibility is exceptionally important to the Prime Minister and to the ministers. I'll use the example of, when we look at things such as a year ago when we put forward the measures to help fishers across the country from coast to coast, on the west coast, east coast, and in the north. Myself and a couple of other MPs in the Atlantic Caucus really led the charge nationally on it. So we had the credibility to be able to bring forth not just the problems, but ideas for change and ideas that kind of look to solutions. So what we know is that Caucus can play a fundamental role in coalescing support, not just within our regional caucus, but with other caucuses and the Prime Minister and Cabinet. The fisheries is one example of it. And, you know, I think there's certainly many more. But the reality is that you come with a track record. And Atlantic Caucus, beyond my time, has come with a track record of honest, forthright, and confidential discussions that lead to national policy. So a real fundamental, the position I have, new position, is of importance to Atlantic Canadians, but it really is the MPs and the team that we have that really drives home the message.
And interesting, before this, you had gotten a youth council underway, and it was stressed in a press release that you had mentioned young people in the riding need their own platform in a situation like this because of the likelihood their opinions will be different than some people who are more senior in their riding. Why is this initiative important to you?
This initiative, like the roaming office, was important to me because I want to try to do politics differently. The Youth Council itself is not a partisan group. We have, and it's not a group located in one particular geographic area. So you have youth that have different philosophies, different viewpoints, and are from different parts of the riding. Why is it important? And it's important because we need to hear from every facet of society. We need to hear from seniors. We need to hear from the working poor, middle class. We need to hear from people that live in rural parts of the riding and urban parts of the riding. From my perspective, and I learned this firsthand, Bill, during the campaign, I learned so much from millennials. It was amazing. I learned so much in terms of passion, work ethic, viewpoints on the environment, viewpoints on economic development. If we're going to excel as a riding, if we're going to excel as an island, if we're going to evolve and grow, we need everybody's input on the table. I look at people like Jill McPherson, who started a cider company in Cape Breton, and I look at the Bitten Moon, and I look at there's a place in Ayrshire that fails me right now. But I see a lot more young entrepreneurs taking a chance, rolling up their sleeves, taking calculated risk, and really being a force for a bit of a renaissance in terms of new businesses in the riding. We need to, if we're going to grow the amount of young people who want to stay here or come here from other parts of the region, we need to be open from a business perspective. We need to be open to newcomers. We need to be open to the art of the possible. And those are not just buzzwords. Those are actual values that we have to act on. I believe we are. We need to do more of it from a youth council perspective. Those ideas, and here's the other thing. I just don't want ideas from the youth council that are strictly related to youth. It could be on economic development. It could be on healthcare. There's plenty of ideas out there that, in my belief, are not cultivated because we're not looking, and we need to start to look. And that's one of the goals of the youth council, not tomorrow, but today.
And something that rattled us all, really, regardless of age group or demographic, the pandemic, of course. And with the vaccine rollout, do you see people are getting more confident in feeling safe with this rollout, or do we still have a long way to go?
I believe that there is growing optimism and confidence with the rollout. You know, we were one of the first countries in the world in December to start rolling it out with vaccines, Moderna and Pfizer in particular. Then we hit a bit of a capacity issue in February for a week or two, but now we've been building it up ever since. And look, we are going to hit our targets for the end of this month, and the Prime Minister has been pretty consistent in saying that anyone that wants a vaccine by the end of September, they will have the opportunity to vaccinate Canadians who want to be vaccinated. So I believe there's incredible hope, incredible optimism in terms of how it's rolling out. And, that doesn't mean that we can stop with the measures that Dr. Tam and Dr. Strang have mentioned around distancing and masks and things of that nature. But I'm very optimistic that we are progressing very well on the vaccines. We have Pfizer, Moderna, we have AstraZeneca, we have Johnson & Johnson. And again, back in the early days, the Prime Minister said, we're going to go after an assortment, a portfolio of vaccines. Well, this is why. We want to have as many vaccines at our disposal as possible. So I'm very optimistic. I like the rollout. I like the pace that we're undertaking with the vaccine. I know a lot of people in my own family that are on the cusp of getting their vaccine. So there is light at the end of this tunnel, and the light is shining now. We've got some ways to go, but we're in the right direction.
The federal government is looking to help with the next major disaster, and we had spoken briefly about this before, and whatever that will be, anything from a cyber attack or another pandemic and anything in between. So it's basically coming from national defense, and they're looking for studies and ideas to allow us to keep our guard up. And what are your thoughts on this? Will this type of exercise be helpful in curbing something like COVID-19 if it comes around again?
100%. I think we now know that we live in a time where, for a lot of reasons, there could be other health-like events like COVID-19, and we want to be prepared. So that means you want to be proactive. So you want to be, for example, to have the ability to produce your own vaccines. And so we've made a commitment to develop that process and approach and everything that goes with it in Montreal to be able to produce our own vaccines. So we're not totally reliant on other distributors. But it goes even deeper than that. We need to look at how do we prevent, how do we triage, catastrophes or issues or challenges that may emerge, whether it be a global pandemic or other. And so when the government is asking for insight, that's encouraging. No matter what government is in power, when they're saying, we want to hear from organizations, we want to hear from individuals. Well, that I can tell you firsthand, that's not just a passive exercise. That's a real exercise to be able to get people's input in terms of how do we look at prevention, how do we look at maintenance, how do we look at triaging global challenges and issues that may be a health-related item or directly a health item. So I like the fact that we're doing this because I think what COVID has shown us is that every government in any country, it's incumbent on them to do what they can now to prepare for the future. And that's what you can ask for your government. What can we be doing now to prevent something from happening? It doesn't give you 100% success rate, but when a government looks at how does it protect its citizens, that's one of its number one goals. How do we protect our citizens? And that is not just a value, that's a value in action. You have to live it. And so I like the fact that the Department of National Defense is taking the lead on that.
In your opinion, do we have any homegrown resources here in Cape Breton that could contribute globally on a level like this?
Well, I think you look at some of the existing businesses that we have here. Like if you look at businesses like our distilleries, we saw firsthand places like Lenora that were able to make modifications to the distillery to provide hand sanitizer. We have probably, I think, one of the, the strongest healthcare personnel that I would stack up with any in the world. We have a great university in Cape Breton University that is, focusing on alternative energy, which can play a role in preventing future catastrophes, depending on that whatever catastrophe we're talking about or challenge or issue. So we have assets like the university, like our healthcare system, that provides sound guidance and support. But then we have businesses like Protocase. We have businesses like Glenora, Breton Brew, and others that you think Breton Brew can prevent the next pandemic. Perhaps they could, depending on the technology they have to make their product. As an example I just gave you, Glenora was able to make modifications to their distillery to be able to kind of produce hand sanitizers. So, and then we have our armed forces. So we have, in the North End and in Glace Bay and in other places within Cape Breton, we have battalions that are trained, that are focused on helping Canadians. And we'll probably see them playing more of a role in future global challenges. Our talent is great, Bill, and it's varied. And I think what we've realized through this pandemic is that in Cape Breton, Canso, we're an island. And in the case of the riding that I focused on, parts of northeastern Nova Scotia, but we're so interconnected to every level of society, whether it be food security. I think of Alicia Lake and the Cape Breton Food Hub and the great projects that she has going on, and those that she's working on lend themselves to a national, international solutions provider in terms of providing local food security. So I love the talent we have in the riding. It's varied, and it can be used not just for local, regional, national, but international solutions.
Interesting. Yes, the local talent, like you said, used on a global level. A Nobel Prize winner in physics, Dr. Art McDonald from Sydney, his team helped develop a ventilator during the pandemic. I think his team was researching neutrinos at the time, whatever that means exactly, whatever they were doing.
But, I'm not sure either.
But they stopped what they were doing to go into this production. So it's interesting. Yeah, the talent does seem to be here on many levels.
Absolutely. Listen, innovation, 9 times out of 10, in my opinion, comes from generalists. They're working on something. There's a group of generalists, but each one of them brings something to the table that kind of connects and creates something more meta, something bigger than what they were working on. And if we could take anything from this pandemic, is the power of community, the power of innovation, the power of resiliency, the power to just push through. And, to put it in perspective, Bill, and to the listeners out there, this time last year, there was no vaccine. And in less than a year, global resources were pooled together from a health side, from a research side, but let's go even deeper and local. I mean, last year, did we classify the stock person at the Sobeys as an essential worker? No. Are they essential worker? You better believe they are. The truck driver, the fisher, the farmer. There's so many more. So it's helped redefine what people do, why they do it, but more what we can accomplish together because of it.
Okay. Thanks for calling, and we'll speak soon.
Okay, Bill. Take care.
That's all for Dialogue this week on The Coast 89.7. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly. Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.